Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 27th, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off today. Article from Google Threat Intelligence Group. It's titled, "Hello, Zero Days, My Old Friend." It's a 2024 zero-day exploitation analysis report. So there were some trends and some details in this report. I thought it was pretty interesting. Definitely a lot of bullet points to talk through. I'm going to kind of hit on some of them and then dive into some conversation at the end of this. So in 2024, there were 75 zero-day vulnerabilities exploited in the wild. And that's a decrease from 98 in 2023, but still higher than the 63 in 2022. Pretty much indicating a persistent threat landscape. 44% or 33 of those vulnerabilities targeted enterprise technologies. That's up from 37% in 2023, highlighting the shift towards exploiting the security and network products. So focus on that there. There's 20 zero-day vulnerabilities identified in security and networking products, compromising over 60% of enterprise targeted zero days. So a point to be taken from this analysis as well, just to add more depth to that, you know, 33 of the 75 zero days reported for 2024, compared to the 36 zero days out of 98 in 2023 towards this side, you know, really does expand on that trend that shows attackers' strategic focus on that infrastructure still. And when compromised can obviously lead to extensive system and network breaches. So some other points here, if we talk about things like browser and mobile exploits, so zero-day exploits in browsers decreased from 17 in 2023 to 11 in 2024. And mobile device exploits dropped from 17 to 9 in that same period. Notably, iOS and Safari had significant decreases. So they were at a 5 combined in the report for 2024, down from 20 in 2023. So this decline suggests improved security measures in those platforms, redirecting attackers elsewhere. And Chrome, from the browser side, still remained the primary focus for browser zero-day exploits, having 7 reported, up from 6 in 2023. So espionage activities and attribution, over 50% of attributed zero days in 2024 were linked to cyber espionage actors, including state-sponsored groups and commercial surveillance vendors. Notably, both DRC-backed and North Korean actors were each responsible for exploiting 5 zero days, indicating a kind of a diversification in state-sponsored cyber attacks, if you will. A couple other additional points. So Microsoft Windows exploitation continued to increase, climbing from 13 in 2022 to 16 in 2023 and now 22 in 2024. It's really showing that continued focus on the popular choice for, you know, the end user home and professional settings for that OS or those products. Threat actors continue to utilize zero-day vulnerabilities primarily for the purpose of gaining remote code execution and elevating privileges. And in 2024, these consequences accounted for over half, which was 42 of the total tracked zero-day exploitations. So I thought they were pretty interesting stats, you know, clearly showing the trend over time and seemingly amplified focus by threat actors to find and utilize zero-day vulnerabilities and exploits. A topic for conversation came to me here, Scott, and I kind of want to get your thoughts is, let's say you're in a position on a security team within a company and you're responsible for threat hunting, let's say. And a new zero day is announced, but you don't really have any data on a known exploit to better understand the tactics and techniques and things used to exploit it. What might be your approach? Like, would you consider like an unstructured type of hunt to kind of proactively gear up for coverage? Would you wait for more information on a known exploit before doing so? I have a few thoughts myself here, but, you know, to take a breath for a second, I kind of want to hear what your plan of attack might be.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this data is really good, for one, before I answer or go dive directly into that. And that is, it kind of highlights that obviously vendors are taking, secure coding more serious or putting a lot of effort right into it. And so you start seeing some of those, gaps kind of closing, but open up in other areas. And I think that's just kind of the nature of, hey, if people are coding better, then it's not so easy for you to stumble across these zero days as if like there was just poor coding. So you can kind of like at a glance look at something and find a hole. So now it takes a lot more time and potentially money and backing to spend a lot of time on finding exploits, which means that you only want to spend time on products that are going to give you your biggest bang for your buck. And so that comes down to anything that is potentially public facing to get a foothold. That's a big, you know, enterprise type vendor that, you know, if you find something can be beneficial at mass, and two, security products, because usually they're kind of exposed, some of them externally, so they can help you get a foothold, but also you're looking for ways to potentially exploit, take advantage of them so that maybe you can limit their effectiveness or visibility. So two big drivers there. So understanding potentially those drivers as a threat hunter, you mentioned some unstructured stuff. One, if I know what systems are publicly exposed, potentially can be touched for exploitation, as that being like the initial part of the attack, like the start of the chain, I'd want to be aware of what data is around that. So first finding data sources and data that we could potentially collect, and then kind of understanding and trending that data a little bit just to understand what's normal. Because, you know, like we've talked about in the past, doing instant response, if you look at something you've never looked at before, everything looks kind of bad, even though it could just be standard errors and reporting and logging for like debug type stuff. Who knows? So that's kind of how you get ahead of that game when you're worried about 0 days and things like that. The second is understanding what actions kind of on objective in general. And we talked about, there's a lot of government backed groups. So you kind of differentiate from like that whole ransomware get in, be loud and proud at a certain point. There are more groups that want to learn the environment and stay present in the environment typically, which caters a lot better to threat hunting, because one, there you have the time element kind of on your side. And two, there's going to be a lot of the activities that threat hunters should commonly be hunting for anyways. It's kind of leveraged by all groups, but there's going to be a lot more noise on like the lull bin type side and kind of the, like the how do I understand and navigate an environment without using custom tools. And so that's another place I would focus on. And so then you kind of look at, okay, so you kind of understand where points of entry could potentially be based on exploitation and things you have. And then two, you understand kind of what's adjacent to that. So even if you want to say get highly specific, you can kind of be a little more aggressive on some of the things you hunt for that are kind of like that next level in, if you want to do like a subset of your enterprise. But then, you know, it's always good to like, you know, hunt across everything so you can understand what's, you know, normal and not too. But yeah, that's kind of how I typically approach that. I know it wasn't like a very specific answer, but it's kind of like that mindset you could put yourself in. Okay, what does discovery usually look like? And out of like all the groups that I know about how they operate, what's a common thread in discovery? You know, what type of lull bins are typically used? At what points of execution? You know, when you're looking at PowerShell usage or command line or command prompt usage on the Windows side, and then on the Linux side, typically you're kind of looking at server environments, but hopefully you have the visibility there to look for like things where stuff gets chmodded. If there are specific payloads and, you know, uses of moving payloads for downloading, like PowerShell for downloading, curl for downloading, you know, all those types of things, you kind of put it all together. And the last step to that, you know, puzzle is being proactive. Cause the last thing you want to do is, you know, you get asked by your leadership, like, hey, we know all these 0 days are hitting. What are we doing about it? You don't want to say, okay, we're going to start doing this. It's a much better conversation to say, hey, we already kind of have a plan in place. We understand these are how attacks typically evolve. So we're always addressing this as a threat. So we'll keep doing what we're doing while looking into if something just broke, right? What may be slightly different or new, if we want to adjust anything or validate what we're doing actually works. And that's kind of how you grow too. So those are kind of the conversations and mindsets you kind of put yourself in. I don't know if that answers your question as best as possible, but that's kind of my generic approach to stuff like that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's really just wanting to understand your thoughts. And you know, from my side, I always look at this and I thought it's, It's really good report. I love stats, and I know you like stats. It's cool to see this stuff. Trend and analysis really helps you think proactively. So when I'm thinking about it from a security side, especially from a hunting side, like having some level of playbook when these things are delivered, because I know I have been set on fire before for these, right? Like some 0 day gets announced in the news, it hits, you know, the right media feeds that hit your C-level folks or your executives, that, you know, the fear starts finding its way down the chain, and then you're asked to, hey, how are we protected from this? Are we sure? And a lot of times some of that comes down, and you really don't have enough data to make a decision there, right? But you can't say nothing, right? So it's kind of always been this thought that, and this one struck it up for me. It's like, what would be things that I would do? And I've thought about this before, but it's like, what would be things I would do from a hunting standpoint if my CISO came down to me and say, hey, you know, can we actively see if we've been exploited, even though there is no known exploit, or, you know, we don't even know if the 0 day is capable of being leveraged in that specific way, but you have some information, right? So just as a soft example, like approaches that I would think would lead to kind of that unstructured hunt, or at least developing a bit of a playbook for it if this situation were to come up that you had ready to play. You know, as a soft example, there are plenty of depth of the things that could happen on a given system, especially things if you talk about like a Windows OS, right? We know a lot of the things that occur there. So you could have this rundown of, okay, if I have this exploit, somebody comes to me and it's going to be an exploit, it's this system, and I don't have a baseline, because baselines would be great. I'd love to see us move to a place where we really know our environments and have set baselines for that. But I don't think we're there yet across the board, across industry, right? So what would I do? I think a simple thing would be, okay, well, let's go through an X amount of time when I know the targeted window for this exploit has been discovered or might have been there. Maybe expand that window a little left, deeper in time if you have the ability to dig through the data, and just pull, you know, counts of different windows of NIDs, break them up by specific time frames. Maybe you see something that stands out there. So these kind of soft, unstructured approaches that you can look at to narrow in on something that, hey, this might be something that I don't know, you know, without having too much of a wide range of things to target for. You know, you look at your things like your registry edits, like your log on activity. There's some basic stuff that you can kind of circle down this, you know, say you have coverage. I think in tandem with that too, though, I think an answer is always, we're constantly looking to see if it's been exploited, and not, you know, try to get to that information before your CISO hands it to you, right? But yeah, it was thought provoking, because it's a lot of security things tend to go down this path where you don't have an easy playbook to answer or help protect your environment. So it was pretty thought-provoking for
me. I mean, like it's tough, because as a security practitioner, you understand there's multiple legs to an attack. And from a management perspective, you hear 0 day exploit and you think that's all that's required. So when you sit there and say, well, we don't understand, there's no technical detail around this exploit, they just feel immediately you're unprepared, because you don't know what's going on either, because it's not released or you don't understand it. And it's like, that is literally the first step of the attack, right? So making leadership feel like you are prepared, it's putting that in that perspective, with the exception that if there is an exploit that does like a denial of service to some sort of application, there's nothing as a security practitioner you can do against that other than trying to block specific traffic, reboot services when they do get hit, and just patch at that point. That's, you know, but that's not the type of attack threat hunters you usually, that's more of an operational security measure. But yeah,
for sure. And I think having like a level of knowledge to say it, to your point there, if I'm hit with, hey, you know, here's this Windows 10 0 day XYZ, and somebody comes down to me, hey, have we been affected by this? And like, we really don't have any other details other than this like generic, hey, there's this exploit that could lead to RCE, could lead to remote code execution. Well, then you think, as the security practitioner, what are they going to do when they gain access? And then what kind of code would they execute? And then from there, you can easily extrapolate, okay, well, we have these things in place, and you can respond in kind to that, right? Like you could say, these are the things we do know, these are the things we're watching for. And then if you're, you know, able to have a baseline type of thing to go against, or you have the space to unstructured go after, you know, some digging to provide additional details, like those are, I think from my perspective, those are good answers, good approach, and, you know, kind of on the ready types of things to have in your pocket. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Well, moving on, Scott, what do you got next for us?
Yeah, I'll jump in with some data driven stuff, right? So This is the Q1 report Cloudflare put out. And it says it's their DDoS threat report, you know, targeted by 20.5 million DDoS attacks, up 358% year over year. Cloudflare's 2025 Q1 DDoS threat report. So I think it's always good to like I just mentioned, like DDoS, you don't really care about that from a threat hunt perspective because you're kind of more leaning post exploitation. But as a security practitioner, I think it's really important to understand this is a risk. And so Cloudflare has a really good visibility into a lot of things because they protect a lot of applications and services. But, you know, they saw some stats, you know, from this around one third of that, you know, 20.5 million DDoS attacks, about 6.6 million. They actually targeted the Cloudflare network infrastructure directly, which is interesting. Cloudflare blocked approximately 700 hypervolumetric DDoS attacks that exceeded 1 terabit per second, or one, I guess, BPPS. Is that bigger than terabit? Is there, I don't know what the thing above terabit is, but I'm assuming that's bigger. I don't know. But that's an average of around 8 attacks per day. And, you know, they throw some other interesting things in there as far as like, you know, they have like an 18-day multi-vector DDoS campaign. They were doing SIDN flood attacks, Mirai-generated DDoS, and SSDP amplification attacks. So kind of understanding the type of attacks are being thrown around. And I think, you know, a lot of this stems from, in a lot of ways, you know, smart devices and the growth of botnets in general. It makes these attacks a lot easier and obviously way more intense. But, you know, they also mentioned what I thought was interesting was the duration of a lot of these attacks. And so that was interesting to me because they said, see, where's the stat specific on the time? But they were saying that they 90, I think, was it something like 94% or no, 75% of the attacks end within 10 minutes. So that to me, well, 89% of layer 3 and 4 in 10 minutes, and then 75% of HTTP DDoS attacks was 10 minutes. And that's interesting because you got to think like, well, even if I was monitoring my own stuff, by the time I see an alert, try to figure out what's going on and react to it, the attack is gone, and they make a call to that. And obviously they're kind of selling, well, if you have automated services to deal with this, then you won't even have to really respond and you don't have to worry about it. And yeah, 10 minute DDoS in a lot of cases. Okay. So you had like a hiccup in services, but then if you have like a lot of infrastructure behind that and applications and stuff that when that interruption causes a trickle effect that causes failures and things need rebooted and stuff like that, that can be impactful. But another thing that was interesting, they said, I think something like 6% of a lot of, reported attacks were launched by disgruntled or former employees. That to me, it was just kind of weird, right? Because I don't know. I just can't put myself in the shoes where like, ooh, I'm going to take down the website and I feel better about myself. It just like with how quickly some organizations can respond to that, it really just becomes a nuisance. But either way, it's just fascinating to see what types of attacks are being shown. They have like a breakout of like UDP versus HTTP type of attacks, and the different types of like network layer. You know, they have the ESP floods, the CLDAP flood, Synax. They have all the different types of like the percentage of growth. They even have like BitTorrent floods and TCP floods. But you know, it's good to understand this because from a strategy perspective, this is where, like, I mean, obviously you can use the services like Cloudflare, but, you know, a lot of people have been talking about going to and from cloud, right, as far as hosting their stuff. Well, in some instances, this is something, a benefit where if you do go to the cloud, you have the resources or you potentially have just the way the cloud is set up to kind of protect against some of these things as well from an availability standpoint. When you design things, having distributed services, there's a lot of strategies that you do need to take into consideration in these days, because the ability to just saturate stuff becomes easier and easier with the more devices we actually connect to the internet, and the way the bots and things grow. So, you know, I thought it's like a good report to have numbers, especially when you're having conversations with strategy, leaderships, application developers, architecture, all that kind of stuff. This should always be a piece of that. Sometimes you can't, you know, avoid it, right? If you're in a data center or in a place where if it just gets slammed physically, there's nothing you can do about it. That's kind of a risk you have to understand, and what does that mean? But you know, if you're not thinking about it, then as this grows, you might even be potentially a victim, even though you're not the target, because these things are getting so big. If something adjacent to you, or if you're sharing data center space and things like that, depending on where you're hosting your stuff, you potentially could just be a victim just because someone else is being targeted. So it's really just, you know, like you brought the whole 0 day stuff, kind of food for thought when it comes to thinking about DDoS. And there's some just really great metrics to understand the type of attacks that are happening. So yeah, what are your thoughts?
Couple things, you know. So I, you brought it up. So, you know, while I did some fast research because I was generally curious. So the terabytes per second versus the BPPS, that's a billion packets per second. And they're kind of like
Oh,
an
packet
equivalent
based.
marker measure. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so people do sh like send like fragmented or short packets, and that is in effect not saturating the network pipe, but saturating the network cards or chipset's ability to handle packets. So like a switch, you can overwhelm much faster, I think, with doing smaller packets than actually sending lots of data, you know, stuff like that.
Like certain switches, you know, they might have like a, you know, a million or 1.5 million packet per second handling. You hit it with 4 billion, it's going to freak out. One of the things that I found that I took out of this, and it's a little bit of a curveball, but as they were showing some of the statistics and data, and I like the charts, there was one that specifically stood out to me, and I this started my brain down a path of thinking about this as an attack vector, well, an attack a launch point for somebody to consider attacking you. The threat actors, the top threat actor types reported by Cloudflare customers that were targeted by DDoS attacks. And there was one that stood way out, and it was the competitor. So like a company's competitors, how I read that, they were at 39% of the data that they showed, comparable to like state level sponsored attacks at 17, disgruntled customer user 17, self DDoS 11%. Found that interesting,
That's
but
kind of
totally
funny.
understand that. And yeah, so the competitor vector was interesting to me because that, you know, I never really thought about that. Maybe because in my experience, I haven't necessarily had to, but I could see how certain industries may need to consider that, where, you know, you could be targeted by a competitor to, you know, to increase their
Well,
side.
I feel like the competitor thing also typically doesn't exist within the same country. Right. I feel like if you're a global, it's a global competitor because there's different rules, laws, and things there that I think not necessarily enable that, but don't deter it. Yeah.
And I don't think you see a lot of days, a lot nowadays reported to where it's, you know, it's pretty easy to mask an attack like this with the levels of botnets and the technology that's there to be able to, you know, handle this size of volume and stuff. And, you know, people aren't. I don't really hear, maybe you do, maybe I'm just missing it. I don't really hear about people being targeted for takedown on these things. They, you know, they're just more put in a gate to be able to handle the flow to make sure your systems stay up and just be able to, you know, to survive it really.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is great data. It's definitely something to think about. I can't, I'm stuck in the competitor things. It's very interesting to me because I'm starting to think about other things like, you know, what do we consider communications from certain competitors? Are there things that are, you know what I mean? There's just a whole rabbit hole to go down thinking about that type of, you know, source. All right. Jumping into the next thing for this week. I have an article from Netcraft, back to a topic we actually talked about a few months ago, but a little, I think, interesting addition and something to really consider. So, from Netcraft, titled AI-enabled Dark Helix Suite makes phishing kits more accessible and easier to deploy. So this article again touches on a topic we discussed a bit a few months back. Dark Helix is a phishing as a service platform, and is a very in-depth platform that allows for pretty detailed and quick to deploy phishing campaign, building, tracking, etc., including the functionality to emulate any brand or website, deploy deception techniques within a created campaign, and dashboard tracking tools and more, all in a very user-friendly, easy to use, excuse me, low barrier of skill set. And it's all built in in this app. And recently there's been some notable updates. So Darkula Efficient is a service platform. It's integrated generative AI capabilities, allowing users to create customized phishing pages with minimal technology or technical knowledge. This AI-assisted feature enables rapid deployment of tailored phishing campaigns, including multi-language support and form generation, without any requiring of programming skills. So Darkula's infrastructure utilizes modern technologies like JavaScript frameworks, Docker, Harbor, really aimed to resembling that legitimate SaaS offering in its design and its operation. The platform offers a subscription-based model, providing users with tools to impersonate organizations across various countries, facilitating widespread and targeted smishing attacks as well. Really looking at the significant impact and ongoing threat, Netcraft reported that it had identified and blocked over 95,000 malicious Darkula URLs and had taken down more than 20,000 malicious domains associated with this platform just in the recent couple months, which is pretty incredible in my opinion. Darkula continues to evolve with its latest updates and, really enhancing that ease and speed in which cyber criminals can launch phishing campaigns. And it's just this constant threat that's growing. So, mostly, Scott, I really just bring this to the table this week as an update on this front. I think it's worth noting and watching these types of things. This one has stood out to me, especially this year, because it's easy. It's ease of use in the things that you can see and in the reports that we've talked about. Just they're fascinating because it's almost like, what as a defender are you going to be able to do as these things advance? It's just a fascinating tool. And I just wanted to bring it back up to conversation, make sure that it's put in the light. It's a simple, straightforward thing, but I really believe from my perspective it's worth noting. So what do you think, Scott?
Yeah, no, this is in security, we always talk about how like the weakest link is the person, right? And in some cases that's true because people are so variable and dynamic. And one of the things they called out in here, which I liked because they talked about the smishing, is there's so many great securities now built in to how we use phones and send text messages, where things are kind of encrypted point to point, all this kind of stuff that's layered on top that makes it really even hard for security like tools to do anything in the middle of all that, because when you finally get to you, it's the reader, it's the really seeing it firsthand. So this is kind of shows how attack services are being leveraged, how adversaries are really trying to attack the human. And I think we talk about how AI in itself, the whole language model approach, really helps with social engineering or aids with it. Security awareness is just, I think, going to be a more important field probably over the next decade as it comes to this, than we probably give it credit for. And I say that because I know a lot of organizations that don't have a dedicated security awareness program, or I wouldn't even call it a program, it's a person, right? And I feel like there's just this constant training for best practices and things to do, because for instance, in a lot of these campaigns that are driven by this, they're just basically sending links to go to directly to your phone to get you to then interact and then see things that look legitimate and feel legitimate and stuff like that. But if you're getting messages like that from things and numbers you don't know, I mean, it's the same training we get with emails and stuff, as don't you shouldn't be clicking on those, and you should be trying to report those. And it's not, it's the whack-a-mole game if you try to do something about it necessarily, but a user should be empowered to make good decisions. And I think it kind of comes to that, and that's what's really good about this type of reporting that highlights some of the effectiveness and the dynamicness and the capabilities associated. Now, it's cool that there's vendors that can track based on the different tool sets that are behind a lot of these campaigns and builds. I think those are really important. But it's the cat and mouse games there as well. I think security awareness and the significance there as far as training. becomes just an important step to this kind of surface that we see.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a lot of depth to be there, especially, you know, in our current landscape when it comes to the mobile type of phishing stuff, like text messages and anything like that. Like, that should be an easy one to decipher. You shouldn't be expecting, you know, these types of things to come through there. And they're pretty rampant, and I think all of us are seeing them more. It's definitely a focus area from threat actors. Tools like this are clearly making it easier to you know, deploy in mass. And I think we're going to need to see technology help catch us up. It is going to be interesting to watch, though, because it's just the phishing side has always been our, you know, the nail in the coffin for a lot of things, because it's just the one area we really can't ultimately prevent, because, like you said, the user in the end. But when tools are making it even more easier for people to fall for a lure, it gets a little scary, you know. So that the, you know, that depth and that next level of stuff that we talked about, like we did with 0 days, is looking at, you know, what do you have in place if you were to be, you know, hit through this vector.
And I would almost say too, the other thing to think about in a lot of these instances is, you know, what's the motivation a lot of times. And I feel like, you know, still gathering credentials is a big part of it. So when you want to say, like, as a security practitioner, like, other than training the end user, which it's hard to guarantee good results necessarily, you will get results, but there's like no guarantee. But because, you know, a big driver of some of these things is to for people to gain legitimate credentials and potentially access, you should have a good approach for how you manage or monitor how people are accessing things and from where and what are abnormalities there and things like that. And so, you know, it's kind of a data approach. There's obviously some generic alerts in a lot of authentication systems that will tell you about weird things that you should be aware of. But that's, I think, from a technical approach where you really focus your efforts on, if this is a problem or you think this problem is going to be growing, have a good strategy there, have a good understanding of those data and alerts that come from there, and look at the scenarios that you might be most concerned about based on how your business operates. And that's how you really, I think, address a lot of the credential stuff, is if you know how your people work and how your company, you know, works, as a global, is it regional, is it whatever, that helps a lot as well. So,
absolutely. All right, what's last this week, Scott?
Yeah, so last one, I'm going to actually dive into something a little more technical, but it's not super technical. It's just kind of interesting. And that is, it's a report from Cyfirma, I guess is how you would say that, but it's a technical malware analysis report. And it's based on a Python-based rat malware, your remote access Trojan, right? What's interesting here is, it's a Python-based remote access Trojan, but it's utilizing Discord as its command and control, and it kind of disguises itself as a benign script. With it, uses some, you know, built-in Python libraries, just makes it very easy to utilize. But what's effective is clearly it's using things that are built in and or utilized in the system. So it's really hard in this aspect for defensive tools to flag it, unless you're going off of hash and those types of indicators. From a behavioral standpoint, it's just doing system-based things that systems just do or can do. So nothing really stands out. But it still does some basic things, right? So, you know, they did some static analysis. And what I like, sometimes when it comes to static analysis, there's some strings or keywords that pop up. And the more you look at attacks, the more these things will resonate with you too when you look at things. So that's why I think it's important to kind of always just be reading something. But they basically have, they copy itself to the Windows Startup folder. And you can see that with their static analysis, they show where it has the directory and it's joining. So it's making the OS path of Microsoft Windows Start Menu Program Startup, right? And they're basically the program that it's using the deceptive name Windows Crash Handler. Handler, I think, is misspelled as well. But that's how it does its whole persistence component. The other thing, obviously, I mentioned that it uses C, that C2 is using Discord, so it actually registers via API to a channel via authentication token. So that's how it kind of does things back and forth. It gathers information about the current user, logged in user, device name, all that kind of stuff. The other thing it does, and this is interesting because I see this happen a lot when big, easily exploitable vulnerabilities get released. There's sometimes, depending on the attacker type, class, and motive, they'll always try to do some sort of geolocation style lookup to understand their victims, especially if they're using like botnets to like mass exploit things and they want to figure things out and figure out what targets they want to invest the time, you know, going after. And in this case, they do something similar. They use the ip-api.com, which is a basically it calls out to this domain, and that domain will return back based on the IP, like the geolocation, so the country, region, city, zip, ISP, GPS coordinates, potentially, depending on what's stored in that database. And I've seen many actors use that same thing, same mechanism. And there's also like a list of services like this. So when you're looking at stuff like that, it's just to say, hey, do we know that list? Are we actually monitoring for that type of behavior in general? And is this on the list? And if not, add it, right? That's the beauty of growing threat hunt packages and maturing them, is you kind of know what you have and you constantly keep them up to date. But if for its malicious functionality, it does like screen blocking, which is kind of dumb, right? It blocks out the whole screen, so it's just like disruptive. It can forcefully blue screen the screen because it calls some undocumented Windows functions, which is funny because I've seen this forced blue screen before in other like malware that's supposed to just be disruptive. So it's interesting it's included here. Obviously, it's an easy thing to, I think, to do. So maybe they thought it would be fun. It can mess up with your mouse. So kind of interesting. It also can create a spiral effect on your screen where it just basically kind of blocks things, but also visually shows something. So it's interesting. It has all these like disruptive capabilities. So it kind of sounds like someone possibly is just kind of having fun building this out. And this, like, it's in a weird way, it kind of feels like someone's like capstone project at a university, right? Like, hey, if I'm focusing on penetration testing, how can I build something? I know Discord, I know Python. I see some functionalities that I can add to prove that I can do things. So it's not like overly threatening. But the components I would focus on is one, they're leveraging some techniques that are already used by other, I would say, bigger attacks. So it kind of validates that it's still worth paying attention to those things, as well as understanding that even something so simplistic as this, they make the call that it'd be really hard for defensive tools to defend against just because it's using system-based things and not some arbitrary files and code that is unique enough for heuristic or signature detection to be as effective. So that just shows that, you know, someone to beat really well-established defenses sometimes doesn't have to be that sophisticated. Kind of call out there. So that's why it's good to be looking for specific behaviors on your own, because these tools that are supposed to protect you might not be aggressive enough for something like this. So yeah, it was a really basic write-up, kind of good to like see all different levels of attacks and what they may look like and what overlaps. So I think this does a good job with that. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that ease of use for stuff like this is kind of becoming more apparent, right? Like, so these, I like the little simple quit hot buttons to push things, you know, like, hey, here, deploy this thing, and here's a remote control to do stuff, and you really don't have to be sophisticated, right? Mm-hmm. I think the one thing that I had taken away from this the most is the idea of the leverage of Discord as the C2 side. And we've seen that before in the past. We see it with Telegram, things like Telegram, even WhatsApp, and so on. The leveraging of those, I wonder how much organizations are considering is this a normal thing in my environment versus not? Like, is this one of those things that you're, and I think even under the threat hunter, it's a simple question. It's a pretty good question to ask. Is there a lot of activity that's going out to Discord and environment in your environment or Telegram or things like that? Is that something that your company needs and or allows, and should it, or at least should you understand the kind of activity that's happening? Because going to these common services that many people use that are not inherently malicious, potentially you could have some good insight there, that if you just think ahead that way, it might be able to get you one step ahead of this kind of attack, is just knowing that part of your environment, right?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point when you talk about like seeing this kind of activity and is that normal? It's really easy to say it's not normal when you don't have a bring your own device policy for work
Correct.
and where people do their work. And I think it's a good distinction is all these methods that attackers can use to kind of blend in with normal, realistic things that they can take advantage of. That is the benefit for them using those, is because of that bring your own device attack surface that people aren't thinking about. Because you might be able to install your own endpoint stuff on there to potentially defend the bring your own device if that's how you do it. If that's allowed. And I know there's like even privacy laws against stuff like that. But yeah, like who's like, there's not like we've talked about, your tools won't defend against this, but the visibility you're able to glean is your only real approach there. So
Yeah, and it was a pretty, from a handful of years back, that it was a fun experiment to just ask that question and go dig into the data that we had in the environment that we were in, and like, hey, how much activity are we seeing out the Telegram? Not something we commonly use, but it was being talked about more to be leveraged by threat actors. So we wanted to understand that in our environment. Discord as well. You started seeing a lot of malware being delivered through Discord, right? And now you
right.
see it being leveraged as the bot. So I think it's definitely a topic worth asking. And if it's not something in consideration, it is a fun little, kind of go dig through the data, maybe call it an unstructured hunt, if you will, but really just kind of understand the data that you have. And I think it would open up some eyes, some things you might see in your environments if you weren't expecting these kinds of communications to these kinds of tools.
No, all good points. So just to make sure to remind and call it out, we have our live podcast happening May 8 from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is our special Guess Who, the Adversary Edition. We're spending a fair amount of time collecting information that we can about a specific adversary, and we're hoping to talk about them and some of the things that they do and some of the things we may consider doing from a defender threat hunting perspective. And hopefully by the end, someone might be able to guess who it is based on their knowledge of the adversary, or there'll be the big reveal at the end. But it'll be kind of a fun approach to really diving into how we look at a specific adversary. So hopefully you guys are able to join. With that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that closes out the top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 27th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.